This is a Connectability Radio production.
The Shared Learning Forum series of workshops brought to you by Connectability.ca and DSTO.com. Understanding Capacity, Competency, and Consent with Elaine Acheson, the Ministry of Attorney General, Ontario. Part 3, Property.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker today, Elaine Acheson. Elaine is the Program Coordinator for the Capacity Assessment Office, the Ministry of Attorney General. She is a registered nurse with experience in psychiatric and psychogeriatric nursing. As a psychiatric advocate, she learned to work with legislation, specifically the Mental Health Act, and she developed an ongoing interest in patient rights and issues of autonomy and capacity. In 1995, Elaine was employed as a treatment decisions consultant for the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee, making last resort treatment decisions under the Health Care Consent Act. As Senior Program Coordinator now for the Capacity Assessment Office, she provides training and consultation to capacity assessors who have qualified under the Substitute Decision Act of 1992 to carry out legal assessments of capacity for property and personal care pursuant to that act. Options for property capable. Again, remember we said guardianship's always last resort. We don't want to go down this road. We don't even want to question somebody's capacity. As long as with support, we're able to work out something that works. It keeps them safe, keeps their money safe. So capable, a lot of your clients have limited skills, can be taught to do little bits of money management, but need somebody supervising for the big stuff. They don't know not to wave the $20 around at the bus station. So there's some discretionary training in there. And you, by only giving them enough that they're not at real harm or risk, can manage informally to help them manage their ODSP benefit, which is for the most part all they've got. If you can get a bank account open, so that you can help them file their income tax and the GST rebate and the income tax can go to the account. And if you can help them write out the check to get the money out or the withdrawal slip. Or the bank will help them do it when they go and say, I want $20. And especially if you're there to support them. Those kinds of informal strategies work quite well. And for the most part, they're more than enough to keep the person safe. If there's only an ODSP benefit, and many of your clients would be there, if they're older, they may be on OASCPP. Federal governments or governments who give out benefits put rules on what can happen if the benefit isn't being spent for the client's benefit. So under ODSP, a group home can become the trustee for the client's check. They can open a trust account, put the money in, deduct whatever you're entitled to for room and board, and then manage the $120 a month with the client. You know when there's a bus trip going to the zoo and it's $10 to get on. You can get it out of the account and get to the zoo. It's a lot faster than having to give 3 or 4 weeks notice to the public guardian's office. It's enough help, enough support. You got to keep records. But the records can be brown envelopes that you stuff the receipts in that are dated, and on the back of them it says, trip to zoo, $10. It's got to be enough that you can easily take it to H&R Block at the end of the year, or whoever volunteers to come in and do income tax. It's all there. It's all accountable. Okay, that's your obligation as a trustee. The information on this is on a website, www.cfcs.com. Children, Family, Community Service, .ontario.ca. Click on Income Support and then ODSP and scroll down a little better than a page and you'll see Trusteeships and the other option, Direct Third Party Payment. Under ODSP rules, if somebody has been at risk of eviction, frequently for failing to pay rent and utilities, they can directly pay the rent and utilities. So the client's left with $250, $300, the spending money, the food and spending money portion of the check only. And again, by lowering the amount of demand, so instead of having to keep track of $930, he now has to keep track of $250. The lights are going to stay on, the phone's connected, and the apartment isn't going to disappear.
So you've lowered the demands on the client, you've made it easier for them to be successful, and if they have months where they blow it all on day 5 of the month, hopefully, like all of us, they're going to learn by experience that that's not a very good thing to do, and they're going to be supported through food banks or soup kitchens or the kind of resources we'd all have to go to if we did that habitually ourselves. Okay, so it's a real experience. But those options exist, so again, not going to guardianship yet if only an ODSP benefit to be managed. Continuing power of attorney for property. The documents that I can create when I'm capable that says if I end up in St. Mike's tonight, this is who's going to look after my money. Who's going to pay my bills, it's my debts, my obligations. It's the whole nine yards. A guardian or an attorney, unless there are restrictions in a document, can do everything the person could do with their finances except write a will. They can apply for benefits, ADP benefits. They can apply for GST rebates. They can apply for subsidies. All of these things have a monetary or fiscal aspect to them. They're obligated to repay debts and obligations or to file bankruptcy on the behalf of the person if it's so extreme. It's a heavy hammer. It is meant to be used for complex affairs where there are legal decision makers needed. If you're capable of doing this, you get to decide by creating a document. This is that step from the Charter. Life, liberty, and security, this authority to do this is new with this legislation. You get to decide by doing one of these documents so that during any period of subsequent incapacity, the person who is authorized by you gets to be your decision maker. So it takes your autonomous choices into periods of incapacity. Sometimes you need to ask for a guardianship for one of your clients because they're about to inherit $20,000 from grandma. And you know that they can't write $20,000, never mind have any vision of how much money that is. That's often a trigger for some of your folks getting assessed. There's some sort of an inheritance, and the inheritor didn't leave it in trust with somebody else named to look after it for the person. They've done Henson trusts, you may not need the public guardian. They've named a trustee within their will. But if they haven't done that, and it's grandma and it's coming and every grandchild got child got $20,000, your developmentally handicapped client who maybe can't manage that money, that may be a trigger for them to have capacity assessment now. Even though the trusteeship's been working fine, now there's a new need, a new demand. It requires legal authority. The executor can't turn that money over unless there's somebody with legal authority to sign the release from the estate. Okay, or mom put the house in her name and her son's. Mom's died. You know, the house now needs the son to decide. And so there's a house now to be managed. Mom did all the bills, looked after all the maintenance and all that. Son can't continue to live in that house because he doesn't have the income, he can't deal with the complexity, he can't be on his own. But there needs to be legal authority for him to sell that house. He's not capable of doing it. Ergo, a guardian needs to be appointed. Okay? So those are some of the scenarios. Again, there needs to be assets. There needs to be a need for legal authority. You can't sell a house if you're incapable. A reputable realtor would not let you sign the closing offer. Okay? Because you don't know what you're doing. You don't know if it was a fair price. There's provision in the Mental Health Act if you're an inpatient in a psychiatric facility to have an assessment by a physician. The Section 16, this is the one that most families use because it doesn't involve going to court. But families may go to court and ask a judge to appoint them again. There's the two ways, either the summary disposition where the judge just looks at the paper evidence or an open court hearing, which is necessary where there's conflict about who should be the guardian for property. And there's no power of attorney appointed, or there's a power of attorney appointed who is not meeting the person's needs, and some other family member says, I'm going to go to court and get a judge to hear the evidence, to look at the books, and see if I can be appointed instead of the power of attorney who's not looking after the client's money for their benefit. Always court ordered for personal care. Under the statute of the Mental Health Act, there's a provision for physicians to assess capacity and fill legal forms that empower the public guardian to be the guardian. Under the Substitute Decisions Act, under Section 16, any person may request a capacity assessment. The requester is responsible for paying. It's a voluntary process. The person has to be willing to be assessed or not refuse. And when the assessor does an assessment under that section of the Act, of the statute, because the rules provide for it, they create legal reports, including a certificate of incapacity. And when an assessor fills out one of these certificate of incapacities, that becomes sufficient authority to appoint the public guardian as the substitute decision maker. It is the only occasion in legislation when capacity assessors not only determine somebody's capacity to decide, but they also create authority for the substitute. Okay, it's an awesome responsibility. It was originally reserved to judges, always had been judges. This is, again, one of those things that got changed in this legislation, recognizing families cannot afford the cost of going to court all the time, and the courts can't afford the time to hear every matter. Once somebody's in under a statutory authority, either from the Mental Health Act or from a capacity assessment, and they want out, they request another assessment. And again, the assessor goes in and asks the questions and tests their ability to understand and appreciate. They've improved and they've now got a handle on things and are able to remember it and reason about it and calculate and do all the things they need to be able to do. An assessor issues another legal report that says, I find this person to be capable. Public guardian only acts for incapable people. Okay, guardianship only operates for incapable people. As soon as you're capable, it stops. When you do powers of attorney, sometimes people put restrictions in their power of attorney. If you're the health provider and somebody says to you, but I have a power of attorney, you always want to see these legal documents. On the property side, you want to know, maybe he named his brother and his sister jointly and they can only do it together. So sister can't come up and say, I want to get $50 out of his trust account. You know, only if brother signs too. And some of them have restrictions in them, and they're usually listed that way, restriction. This document only comes into force in the event my incapacity has been confirmed by my family doctor or my great aunt Mabel or whoever, because I'm capable, I get to decide. And if there's a restriction but no designation, by default it's a capacity assessor, or if a capacity assessor is specified, but you can't substitute a capacity assessor for a doctor. If a person incapable said a doctor, it's a doctor that has to give the opinion on capacity. There are these special Ulysses Clause. These are very special powers of attorney. They were designed for people who suffer from cyclical conditions. So bipolar affective disorder, people with MS, where they can predict because of the course of that illness, they're going to have hills and valleys. And when they're in those valleys, they are going to be disoriented, confused, or for the elated person, when they're on the top of a world, they're going to be very indifferent to by yachts, cars, boats, you name it, you know, the world's your oyster. Okay, but people who know they have a condition like that want to insure against it and make sure they get rapidly treated may do these special powers of attorney. They require a capacity assessment done within 30 days of creating it, saying you're capable in all the areas of personal care, and they require another one 30 days before revoking it. Normally, powers of attorney, if you're capable to give one, you're capable to revoke it. Okay, but with these, you must have a power of attorney going in, and you must have one before you can revoke it, and you waive all kinds of rights to review board and appeals to challenges that your attorney says you're incapable. So there's lots of, these are very legal and very restrictive, and they require lawyers to do them, and they aren't being used. Our guidelines are posted on our website. If you go to the Public Guardian's office, Public Guardian Ontario, put that in at Google. On the list of brochures, there's Capacity Assessment Office. There's a question and answer brochure. When and how and if to get capacity assessments. Below that, you'll find Form 4, which is the formal kind of request for one of these Section 16 statutory guardianship assessments. And below that is a document that is the major training tool that we use to train assessors to do assessments of capacity to manage property or personal care. You may want to go and look at the special considerations for assessing folks with developmental handicap. The four major categories of people who are likely to have or may have an impairment of capacity: people with developmental handicap, psychiatric dementias or other neurological disorders, head injuries, stroke, anoxic events, bleeds, any of those kinds of things. Again, what we know is those with the intellectual deficits and the dementias. When we're thinking about going into a test somebody, we want to know what their threat, what their diagnostic threat to decision making is, because it helps us sort out where we're going to focus our line of questioning. Where is the money on this kind of case? And on a dementia, it's the short-term memory. Okay, you can tell them how much they've got in their bank account. You can show them the check stubs. You can add the column of figures. You can show them the column of figures: household rent, heat, hydro, telephone, the whole nine yards. How much is the check and what else comes in? You can show them. You can do the calculations. But as soon as you close the paper and you talk about the weather for 5 minutes and then you say, now, Joe, how much was your rent? The blackboard erased. They don't remember. We know for the developmentally handicapped, there are things that are critical here for every assessment. We want somebody who's requesting to assure us that the person has been given updated information, that the effort has been made to educate them to the facts relevant to their decision, because we do not want to go in there testing ignorance. Now, assessors need to know some of those facts so they can frame relevant questions. Okay? And they have the right to access health information under the Personal Health Information Protection and Privacy Act under Section 43 because they are doing these legal assessments. Okay, so you don't need to get hung up on what can I tell them. They're entitled to the health information under that section of the Act. They can't ask reasonable questions about what this person has to be able to manage if they don't know what they've got to manage. The test is not about hypotheticals. What would you do if you win the lottery? That's not a valid question in a capacity assessment. It is, how much money do you need to pay for rent? How much money do you get from your check? Where does your check come from? Those are valid, tied to reality, this person's experiences. Okay, but we know also that it's the psychiatric disabilities and the neurologicals, and again, we're talking about high-functioning neurologicals here, people who've been through some rehab. They may have been, you know, virtually unconscious in an ICU unit, and if there was a need for decisions as soon as they stabilized, there's a capacity assessment. If it's a motor vehicle accident, somebody needs to be a litigation guardian to go to court, to work with the insurance companies, to get any monies to argue for funding for rehab, so on. So, but, you know, 2 years later, after really intensive rehab, this person may have substantially recovered. The legal complexity may have sorted itself out. The house has been built with wheelchair access. You know, everything's flowing. And now we know how much it costs every month for rehab costs, for what this person needs. And this person may, because of the rehab, have regained capacity and now be able to make decisions about his property. Okay? But we would want to make very sure that we're canvassing on the appreciate side of the test. Because often folks, especially the frontal lobe folks, whether it's frontal lobe dementia or frontal lobe injury, they can be very articulate and bright and remember the facts and snow you. They're great talkers. They can talk the talk, but they can't walk the walk because they're so disinhibited. The executive functioning piece is gone. They can talk about a plan, but they can't tell you how to get from A to B to C to D. Ask them how to build a set of muffins. They can't tell you, well, you get the cookbook out, and then you get the ingredients out, and then you get the pan out. They can tell you they wanted muffins. They can tell you how much they enjoy them. They can talk about them ad infinitum, but they could no more follow the steps or talk about how to follow the steps and why. we talk about the four bases. The first base I call the Joe Friday test, the facts, ma'am, just the facts. Education. For your clients, this is where your money is going to be. Teaching them the facts, helping them understand, helping them count coins, recognize bills. The second base is able to comprehend the information. So again, we have some people who will be able to count the coins and recognize the bills, be able to tell you this is how much money they get and this is how much rent they pay. So they might know six or eight facts. But then when you try to ask them to manipulate those facts, so if you go to the grocery store and you've told me a quart of milk is $3, how much money are you going to get back from your $20 bill? They can't do the calculation. They can't figure it out. And you have to get to first before you can go to second. If you get out on first because you can't learn and retain the facts, then you're incapable and the assessor writes the report. Okay, you only get to run the basis by getting from one to the next to the next. And you must go all four bases to be capable. Base three, appraise potential outcomes of decision. Focus here is always, the assessors are listening for, is the reasoning process. This is where you're looking at, how does the person explain why they chose this over that? Is it based in reality? If you think you might need an assessment, and you haven't arranged one before, you need a thumbnail sketch of who is the client, what are their needs, what needs to be protected, and what level of functioning do they or don't they have vis-a-vis money management? And they want to see if there's a gap between what the client thinks they own or thinks their income is and what gets confirmed by impartial third parties. And then they write these prescribed legal forms. Again, the legal forms are on the website. You can look and see what are the questions that are asked and what quality of evidence is needed to complete a legal report. I'm going to talk very quickly about the public guardian's office. If you have a new client admitted and you don't know whether he's got a guardian appointed, this is the number you call to find out if there's a guardian appointed. Under this statutory process, Section 16, public guardian gets authority initially. Under Section 17, there is a process for families to apply to replace the public guardian and trustee and become the guardian under the authority of the statute, as opposed to going to court and becoming a court-appointed guardian, which we said is very costly. Okay, so this is what I mean, the quick and dirty into guardianship for family members. You have to be a family member. There's no discretion to appoint friends. Client representatives, these are the money managers, okay? These are the people who look after people's property. You should know for your clients who their client representative is, what the contact phone number is, and get their email addresses. It's usually their name.ontario.ca and their fax numbers. Send them the note. They've got a paper copy for your file. We're going on an outing next month. John needs a new winter coat. At Sears, they're on sale for $60. We need this and this and this. Please tell us whether or not the funding is available for these. Sign your name. I'm the social worker. I'm the whoever. And get John to sign the name if he can and make his mark. Send it off by fax. Facilitates communication. You provided the record of request that they slap into the file. They order the check to be cut. You send in the receipt. In cases where there are extreme cases where you think somebody is being abused or financially, again, these are the rules, where you have grave concerns about somebody who's vulnerable, who's apparently incapable, and who may be either being preyed upon financially or maybe being neglected or physically abused by parents in a home, say. And efforts to try and intervene or to stop it or ameliorate it have been unsuccessful, you can call Guardianship Investigations at the Public Guardian's Office. Remember, their role is last resort. What you're going to get from here is pushback. They're going to want to know, what have you done to try and solve this problem? Have you got more caregiving in? Have you got this in? Have you got that in? And the reason they want to know that is efforts made. Remember we said this is always about least intrusion. The legislation from the beginning is never go to guardianship unless it's last resort. What they want to hear from you is what have you done to try and solve the problem? What agencies have you involved? What efforts have you made? You try and fail, and you document it. Those become the wishing well stones for the public guardian to finally be persuaded. There's enough evidence that all the interventions short of guardianship have been tried and failed that we can now have enough evidence to go to court and ask the court to appoint us guardians in those rare worst-case scenarios.